On July 20th, 1969, Buzz Aldrin was 39 years old, a few months older than Neil Armstrong, as the two men became the first human beings to set foot on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Circling above the moon at that moment in the Apollo 11 command module was Michael Collins, also age 38. Neil Armstrong died 7 years ago, but Aldrin and Collins, both approaching 90 now, are still here to mark the 50th anniversary of one of the most important days in all of human history. And I had the privilege to meet and interview both men, Collins in 1988, Aldrin in 2000. And I'd like to share those interviews with you now, starting with Buzz Aldrin.
You are a true American hero. I'm sure you probably hear those words on a daily basis, but it's got to come from me one more time. You are a true American hero.
It seems to age. I don't know whether that's like cheese or wine or whatever. There were times when I wasn't that sure what great heroes we were. You know, in the early 70s, I mean, right after we came back from the moon, there were demonstrations going, anti-establishment demonstrations, and we were at the Pierre Marquette Discovery Award in Milwaukee, and the students were demonstrating, and they threw eggs at us. Can you believe that? but you know, sense settles in, and I think there is a growing appreciation. Things like the showing of Saving Private Ryan and Tom Brokaw's book of the Last Generation causes a number of people, and I hope it's not just us older guys who reflect back with some nostalgia, but some reverence on the events of the last century.
But not only that, I mean, when I was a teenager, when the three of you went to the moon, made history, made human history. And I remember as a teenager, I'm thinking, boy, that was pretty cool, but I just kind of, it didn't really impact me. Now, in my middle years, I go out and walk the dog at night, and I look up at the moon, and I realize, you walked there. You were up there.
You wouldn't expect this necessarily of the engineers who worked on the program to come up with pearls of wisdom, but what they said is, they, the public, will not realize how difficult a job this is until they try and do it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you try and do something for the second time, especially when you don't have the enthusiasm of the people behind you, mm-hmm. the imperativeness, the pioneering spirit, now all you want to do is go to the moon. Well, we could do it on a shoestring, and it would not sustain itself. It would not. And that's the fear I have of this idea of Mars, and let's go to Mars, and maybe we can go to Mars in a hurry, and we don't have to spend much money on doing it. There are people, brilliant people, who are proposing things. I don't know as I need to mention their names, but they publish a very wonderful book, and he has a society going, but he really wants to do it somewhat on the cheap. The cheaper, the better, and it won't sustain itself. If we do it in a hurry, we'll do it once or twice and then pull back, and then it'll be another 40 years or so. So that's why my approach is to do things in a growing, evolutionary building fashion. And the driving force behind that, I'm convinced, and reinforced by other people, needs to be that the payloads are passengers. They are people in space, adventure traveler, tourists, whatever it is. That is a new industry, and that increases tremendously the flight rate, which right now, with communication satellites getting smaller and consolidating their efforts, the payloads are actually getting smaller in number that are needed in the next few years. And what incentive is there to build reusable rockets if you're not flying that many of them? Just throw them away. They don't get more reliable if you keep throwing them away, but mm-hmm. that's the price you pay. Except when people are on top of those, well, then it's dangerous. It's not safe. And in order to get safe people, into orbit safely, you need to use things over and over again for a period of time before you actually commit large numbers. And we need that next generation shuttle.
We'd become a little lackadaisical about it, a little blasé, a little take-it-for-granted kind of attitude.
That's because it's always happening to the other guy. It's the government test pilot that you'd never heard of who now he's been flying Navy or Air Force or whatever missions, and now he's a very talented person. We're going to fly him in the shuttle. But he's not going to be around long enough for us to really get to know him real well. Because the things that are being done are just not quite that pioneering. They're necessary. They're operational things. And because they're operational, we like them to be routine. And when they're routine, they get kind of, quote, boring. You know, they're not, there's not a crisis going on a mile a minute.
Do you have something in the works that will put me in space at some point someday?
It depends on your salary. Space flight is
or how generous the company I'm working for is.
Well, now that's, you know, we right in the beginning of the book, a network could very easily sponsor a person to fly, and it's very significant and important to me to see that a professional communicator flies in the shuttle early. There's so much of a residual left over from the Challenger accident of what if, I wonder if it's safe. Well, pioneering has its price to pay. There are risks in bungee jumping and climbing a mountain and slipping in a bathtub.
People lost their lives in Conestoga wagons, too.
Well, that's true. And the Conestoga wagons were taking people to do a government-sponsored move, and that was a Homestead Act. The government decided it would assist that movement. It subsidized. And then it kind of subsidized the railroads to get people out of the Conestoga wagons. And then after World War One, the airplane came along, and they subsidized that by conning those guys from barnstorming into the airmail. And the airmail provided the discipline bring about the airlines. Now, we thought we had done something good in the space business after going to the moon by subsidizing the communication industry and the national needs by the ComSat Corporation, which was a good partnership. It stimulated communication satellites. But I think now we're at a stymied place with regard to the rocket launch cost of access to space. And the one stimulus that will change that is people in space. But it's not going to happen by the private sector alone.
Back in 1988 is when I first met Michael Collins.
Your claim to fame as an astronaut was that you were circling the moon as the other two guys were putting their foot. Has that ever bothered you?
No, not in the slightest, Bill. I look at it this way. At the time I was assigned to Apollo 11, there were about 30 of us astronauts. We'd all give a finger or a toe to get on that flight, and I tended to compare myself with the ones we left behind. And as a matter of fact, not just the astronauts left behind, but the thousands of engineers and workers, people who had put a good decade of their lives into that program, and I felt so lucky to be a part of it that I was just pleased as punch, and I didn't care whether I had the best of the three seats or not.
I think there are probably lesser people who would have said, gee, it'd be terribly frustrating to be that close and yet that far.
No, not at all. I've never had that point of view. It's too bad more people can't get into Earth orbit or fly off to the moon. 100 miles up is just a spectacular view. You look out your window and you, off to your left, you can see Alaska, and you swing right on down the Pacific coast to Baja, California. You come screaming in over San Diego. 6 minutes later, you exit over Miami. And if you miss something in the country, well, don't worry, because you'll be back in another hour and a half and you can try it all over again.
Are you familiar with Frank White's book, The Overview Effect?
Yes, I am.
Did you experience that, the sensation of being able to watch all the traffic from above and know what's going to happen next?
Well, I can remember thinking we took off from Cape Canaveral and went around the world once and a half times and then set course for the moon. And there were still people fighting down there in the traffic trying to get home to their, you know, to Orlando or Titusville, Florida, 45 minutes away.
But that really puts things in perspective, I guess, yeah. Doesn't it?
Well, it does. And, of course, the view of the Earth from the moon is totally different than anything I expected. It's so small. First off, frequently you can't even find the Earth. You have to swing your spacecraft this way and the other way until it finally comes around into view, and then it's about the size of your thumbnail. If you hold your arm out in front of you, and you've got a normal arm and a normal thumbnail, that's how small it is. And a beautiful, beautiful, shiny thing. It bounces the sunlight very well, and it shines out there like a little headlight. You see primarily the blue of the ocean and the white of the clouds, and it looks just lovely, clean, but somehow very, very fragile. Fragile, I think, is the overall impression I get.
But it's not at all like what we see in science fiction movies and cartoons, especially, where they're on the moon and you glance over and the Earth is looming as this huge ball right above you.
Well, if your thumbnail is huge, that's how big it is.
Those were really, the 60s were really the salad days, weren't they?
Well, you remember President Kennedy said that we are going to land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth by the end of the decade. He said man because there weren't any women in the program at that time, and he said a man because he wasn't sure it'd be one or more. Turned out we landed Armstrong and Aldrin on the moon by the end of the decade with about 6 months to spare. I think the next long-range goal ought to be planet Mars. I'd love to see us head out in the direction of Mars.
You know as well as I do, though, a lot of people say, why do we need to go to another planet? I mean, we got hunger, we got starvation, we got AIDS and things on Earth that we need to spend money on. Why go to it's interesting to look at from a telescope, but what do you need to go to Mars for?
Well, all those things are true. We do have severe problems down here, but I submit that the space program is part of the solution to those problems. If you look at the money spent on Apollo, first it was spent not a penny in outer space, it was spent in the United States of America, providing interesting high-tech jobs to Americans, keeping our industry, our aerospace industry, a net exporter. You realize we only have two things left that we export consistently, and that is agricultural products and aerospace products. And a buck spent in the space program is seed money that finds its way into other parts of our industry, other parts of our society. Studies, for example, have shown that a dollar spent on Apollo returned about $5 or $6 worth of benefits to other parts of our economy. So that's a pretty good return on investment. But I just like to say, ain't a penny spent in outer space. It's spent right here. And many of the products and processes developed by the space program will be helpful in solving the problems of the cities, health problems, problems of poverty and disease. So I think space helps in a terrestrial fashion, in addition to giving us a kind of a spirit of still being explorers.
Would you like to go back?
Yeah, I would, but I don't think I'm going to have much of a chance. I'm 57, and I've been out of the space program for a number of years now, so better that someone younger goes and takes my place.
Is it that strenuous that someone, once you're past the age of, what, I don't know, 40 or 45, should
actually,
not
go? Actually, it's not. If you go outside a spacecraft, if you make a spacewalk, that's quite strenuous because of the nature of those pressure suits. They're bulky, awkward, cumbersome. They're pumped up full of air, and they want to assume a certain position, just like, say, a bicycle inner tube would. You know, you pump it up, and it wants to be a ring, and if you want it to assume some other shape, well, you've got to squeeze it and bend it and tug it and haul it. And so you have to be in pretty good shape to work inside a pressure suit for very long. But other than that, no, it's a very benign environment, weightlessness.
I'm Bill Thompson. And now I've heard everything.